I think so.
I'm surprised. Seriously. I was sitting through the sessions this morning and this afternoon and all these cool technology sessions, you know, where they show you great demos of the latest and greatest. And then at 4:30 in the evening, we do a privacy session about our processes and how you could deal with privacy. And we still have people showing up. It's actually really surprising. So my name is Roger Halbherr. I'm the Chief Security Advisor worldwide of Microsoft. And it already shows you a little bit of how we deal with privacy. Because our role was created about 10 years ago when Bill Gates started trustworthy computing, and it was really focused on security. You know, I went through these meetings where people were screaming at me because we messed up everything and we were guilty for everything which was out there, which was bad, like Blaster and Slammer and you name it. So our key focus was security back then. And about 2 years down the road, I reached out to our legal people and said, well, I should probably be equipped to talk about privacy, not from a, I'm Swiss, so basically you get some privacy education with your genes, but I need to understand our positions. And then legal came back and said, well, you're not supposed to talk to data protection commissioners. That's something the legal guy do. And I said, well, you know, I face a different reality out there in the subsidiary because it's not about me talking to them. It's actually about them talking to me, which is a different approach. So let me briefly introduce Ton as well.
Thank you.
Go.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Just interactive if possible. I'm Ton Vressel. I'm Chief Security Advisor for the Netherlands and also for the Netherlands the privacy lead. So I want to share with you today the things we do here in the Netherlands and a little bit the European approach and not the Swiss one.
We are not European. We okay. are at the heart of Europe but not part of Europe.
Okay.
So we are trying to give you some views on how we handle privacy, what we learned over these 10 years. And it's kind of my job to show you the design of our privacy program, which we call Privacy by Design. And it's then Tom's job to give you the reality, how it lives out there in the field. So the agenda we are going, Tom is going to do a brief introduction how privacy evolved. You probably know most of that. And then we talk about trustworthy computing, privacy, and the main part will be the third bullet here, which is our privacy governance program. Now, what we are trying to do is we give you a view how you could implement such a program within your company, regardless of the size. Keep in mind that our company employs about, 100,000 to 120,000 people. I heard in another session that we have about 290,000 devices connected to our network, and we have a subsidiary in a lot of countries. And these subsidiaries range from the US sub, which is, I don't know how big, but huge, to the small subsidiaries somewhere in Jordan or in Luxembourg, where we have 7-8 people. And those 7-8 people, they have to cover all the roles, from country manager to finance, HR, privacy lead, security lead, whatever we have. So that's kind of the context in which we run a privacy governance program. And then we draw some conclusions. Now, to start with, I'll hand over to Ton to talk a little bit about the evolution of privacy.
Okay, the evolution of privacy. As we all know here in Europe, we have 27 different opinions about privacy, so we have to deal something with it. And if you compare it to the US approach, it's totally different. The US approach, they have another opinion about sometimes about privacy and regulations, and the Europeans are sometimes in contradiction with each other. So I thought, you know what, I put here a few slides in it from based on the European point of view. As my role for in the Netherlands, I could add some good input. Yeah, there's going. So what you try to do over here is we have 27 different opinions. We have the Article 29 working group of the current GPA here in the Netherlands. He's manager of the Article 29 working group. And if you have the time, I please advise you to visit this website, a very huge website with all material about how they think and how they feel about legislation and according to European harmonization about privacy regulations. That would be a good one. And I think in the end of the day, we have to protect ourselves too. And privacy is not something we just do for fun. It's a necessity nowadays. Privacy is always evolving within the European hemisphere, but also in the American hemisphere, and it's always difficult to achieve that. So what you can see is that there are a lot of incidents happening on daily basis, on weekly basis. Actually, the DPA, I didn't put a slide in here because it was still fresh, is the Dutch DPA had a fine for the National Railroad Company in the Netherlands last week for about 2,500 euros about a serious privacy leak. So privacy is serious money if you don't get it right. This is the thing we would like to address, is that privacy is something we need to do by ourselves.
Let me add a few things to that. FTC, you saw one of the FTC reports, the Federal Trade Commission's in the US, and they made an interesting educated guess. If somebody would read all the privacy statements of all the websites they visit, it might have an impact on the US economy of about $315 to $700 billion. Because these privacy statements are so complex and so intransparent for somebody to understand that they would have to spend a tremendous amount of time. The other thing we see, and that's something you have to keep in mind if your company operates globally, in Europe, typically, the individual owns his or her own data. So when we talk about data about me, the law gives me the right of my data. In the US, it's actually the other way around. So if a company collects information about an individual, it's their data, the company's data, which they have to protect. And this has a lot of implications in the way you look at data. What's important as well, I'm an engineer, I'm not a lawyer, so don't take legal advice from me, please. But that's kind of the way you have to deal in this environment. Now, if you look at the future in the EU and in Europe, it seems like Europe adds a few shades of gray to their law. One is the right to be forgotten, which is all of a sudden adds additional challenges for you if you do privacy in your environment. For us, when we started trustworthy computing, and I'm coming back to TWC or trustworthy computing in a second, we had security by design, and the ones who remember those old times of Blaster and Slammer, you might remember when we came out with SD Cube plus C, it was called secure by design, secure by default, secure in deployment plus communication. In parallel, we started to sneak in something we call privacy by design. Now, it made less noise because we had a serious security problem to solve and not necessarily a privacy problem by then. But this was the start of the privacy by design program. And that's interesting. That's an old slide. That's a really old slide. It's about 10 years old. And back then already, we started trustworthy computing with security, knowing that you can't do privacy without security. We started to do the privacy program. We added reliability because back in the old days, security trust problems were mainly a reliability problem, and the business practices. So the way we behave as a company has to be aligned to those to the other three pillars. But privacy was in there from the beginning, but as I said, the priorities probably shifted. If we look at privacy within Microsoft, it has four wheels, and they are extremely important for us. One is transparency. And transparency is something which is important for us as a company when it comes to privacy, as well as when it comes to security. When you look at the public cloud, for example, you need transparency in both. If you deal with customer data, which most of you probably do, transparency, the way you collect data, the handle data is deleted, is extremely important to me as a user. because, and that's the next step, I want to be in control. So we want to give, and that's the goal of this program as well within Microsoft, we want to give the users control over the access to their data, to their person. How do we deal with the data? What do you want us to do with it? And then we need to secure it, obviously. That's where security and privacy comes together. And there is technology that's sometimes awesome. Internally, we had a discussion during the break before we started. It's sometimes awesome. We have all the technology available, from encryption to information rights management, everything. And still we have leaks sometimes because somebody accidentally forwards an Excel spreadsheet with data in which shouldn't leave the company. So we would actually have the technology, but it's not always applied. And then it's about compliance, obviously, as well. How do we make sure that we comply to all the laws? And this gets increasingly difficult, and I show you the teams which are involved into privacy at Microsoft, but this gets increasingly difficult the more regulation you get across the globe. Because they're not always harmonized, sometimes they even contradict each other. So sometimes you have to keep records for at least 6 months for law enforcement purposes, and in another country, the Data Protection Commissioner tells you that you're not allowed to keep logs for longer than 3 months. So you can kind of pick and choose which law you want to violate. And that's the reality we operate in if you are in a global environment. The way we look at privacy internally is we call it the hub-and-spoke model. Well, trustworthy computing typically does. So at the center, we have trustworthy computing. That's the team which sets the standards, which runs the program. Around that, we have the legal and corporate affairs. Legal and corporate affairs, in this respect, is mainly our lawyers. Now, if you look at Microsoft, we are an American company, obviously. Our headquarters is in the U.S., and often if we deal with lawyers, those are U.S. lawyers. And that's not bad or good, it's just a challenge sometimes because the view on privacy in the U.S. is different than the one in the EU. And I don't want to say it's better or worse, but it's different, which sometimes is a challenge in the communication for international services. You might have the same problems within your company. And then we have the privacy champs out in the different business groups. Now, if you look at our company, I typically tend to split Microsoft in two halves. One is the area where we deliver services and products. That's where you are, our customers, directly consuming a product, an inboxed product, or a cloud service, or any service from Microsoft. So that's actually my opinion, but probably because I don't have to deal with that too much, is the easier part to manage because development at Microsoft is heavily centralized. A lot of the show plays in Redmond, in Seattle. A lot of the show plays maybe in Israel when it comes to certain types of software, or in India or in China. When we operate as a company where we sell products, we do marketing campaigns, where we do HR, whatever, we have all these small subsidiaries across the globe. That's where we are a company like anybody, like any other company, which is slightly different to handle them. So the program, as we look at it, has four pieces of the puzzle, which is people, process, technology, and then we have the tools. So what we are going to do is I'm going to give you some insights into those four hubs, and I want then Tom to jump in and give his view from a privacy lead out here. Privacy lead, privacy manager, how did I? You corrected me before.
Privacy lead.
Privacy lead in the
privacy
Netherlands.
Privacy lead.
So it always starts with people, obviously. The team we have at Microsoft is we have 40 full-time privacy professionals. Now, typically when we talk about 40 full-time privacy professionals plus 400 part-time privacy managers, people go, wow, we will never be able to do that in our company. I'll give you my view why you can and why this number actually isn't too high just in a second. The 400 part-time privacy managers are people like Ton who have their day job, like being the security expert of Microsoft Netherlands for our customers, and then kind of at night he adds the privacy part. So it's not 400 full-time privacy people out there. It's people who do that in their spare time.
Just addition on what you do. I started in here as a chief security advisor, and suddenly they said, hey, we need to do something about privacy. Oh, by the way, you know something, so you have the ball. So it's on top of the things you do. For myself, personally, that's a time-consuming event for about 15-20% of my daily time as a privacy lead.
And probably the reason why it's only, quote-unquote, 15-20% is the way the corp team, the 40 people, look at it is they are the service organization for those 400 people out there. And yep. You see the expertise of the 400 people. They are everywhere. Depending on which organization they are sitting, that's the way they deal with it. Now, the reason why I said I give you a view why I don't think that it's that big, that's part of our business. We have a lot of different products. And I recently had an interesting discussion with somebody who said, you know, Microsoft is a big tanker. No, it's not. Somebody countered that then and said, Microsoft isn't a big tanker. Microsoft is a fleet of speedboats. And if you're lucky, they're all running into the same direction. And then you want to turn this fleet, and speedboat bump into each other. Some miss the turn and go off. New join us. Some sink. And that's kind of the way we work and we operate. So part of the job of those 40 people, which are at the center of gravity around privacy, is to make sure that the speedboats, when it comes to privacy, are more or less aligned, because we have some legal obligations, we have some compliance obligations, and we want to fulfill your expectation when you are our customer. So that's kind of the way we are operating. So those 40 people plus the 400 actually aren't that many. Well, they are, but if you look at the way we operate, they're probably not. That's our virtual privacy team. There are three boxes. The white one is the trustworthy computing privacy team. Then we have legal and corporate affairs, and we have the privacy managers, lead champs, however you want to call them, out there in the field. When it comes to trustworthy computing, and that's an important role you should actually see in your company as well, they are the drivers of this privacy by design program.
The policy makers.
They are the policy maker. They develop the policies, the standards, the processes. But the way they look at it, and I think that's the only way you can successfully land a privacy program, they don't want to be the police agency of Microsoft when it comes to privacy. They want to try to enable the business to do what they need within certain standards. And I think that's an extremely important thing to do. A few years ago, we did a study. I think it was UK, France, Germany, it was in Europe. And we asked the marketing guys, that was part of the study, we asked the marketing guys, when you do a new marketing campaign, not internal, it was our customers, when you do a new marketing campaign, how often do you consult your privacy and security guys? And we asked the same question, the privacy and security guys. How often are you consulted when marketing does a new campaign? The view of the privacy and security people was about, I think, about 70% of the time they're actually involved. The view of the marketing team was about 20 to 30% of the time they really ask the privacy people. And part of the reason is a fairly simple one. If you are a security guy, if you are a marketing guy, you typically say no when they want to do a new campaign. So you won't be able to successfully land it. And they try to do a different approach, knowing that it's difficult. So they are responsible for the standards, policies, for the strategy, for the framework. They do a lot of training and tools, and I'm coming back to the training in a second. And when somebody leaves the company, when a privacy manager leaves the company, they are engaging with the captain of the speedboat, in other words, with the executive of the business group, to backfill this position and train the people, which is sometimes a challenge. They work with legal. And then last but not least, we are aware that things go wrong, so they manage the escalation process, which I'm going to touch in a few seconds. Then we have legal and corporate affairs. That's the pink, violet, or whatever box there. And I think the biggest challenge is to keep abreast of all the international data protection laws and regulations. What's going on out there? How do we want to change, or how do we have to change our behaviors and processes and standards because of the Article 9 Working Party here in the U.S. In the EU.
Sorry.
That was a good one.
It's a 29 Working Group.
Yeah. Thank you. So what does that mean? In which direction do they go? What's the future of these laws, and what does that mean for us? They work with our central team to ensure that we actually meet these legal requirements, and then they have to give legal counsel. Now, the experience I made working with these lawyers is, that's kind of the advice I can pass over. Try to find a lawyer who tries to do risk management instead of taking the law black and white. Typically, when you read a law, it's rarely yes or no. Even if you reach out to a data protection commissioner, I did that in projects, I included them in a country and said, help me to understand how I have to design my system to comply with data protection laws and regulations. And typically they come back to you and say, well, you know, the law is like that, but we never know what the judge actually decides, so we can't give you a clear yes or no. And the same is true with the lawyers internally. Try to find the lawyers who help you to understand the risks. When it comes to privacy, it's not that different from security. Understand the risks you take and include the expectations of the user. It's not always good if you just follow the law. Sometimes if I enter something, if I read something, you create an expectation with me as a customer. So try to understand how you fulfill this as well. They craft the privacy statements. We combined one big one, and then we have smaller ones for different services. And then the other thing is, fairly often there are consultations from policymakers where they reach out and say, we want to change our privacy laws, or we want to work on one. What does Microsoft think about that? We see that happen fairly intensively currently in Asia, because a lot of Asian countries, they are really strong on privacy just now. And fairly often they reach out to the industry and say, if we would do that, would that make sense from your point of view?
Yeah, and Roger, we are also involved in the European Union. Yeah? We have also the interaction between the EU and in Brussels. And the European Union, about 27 different opinions about something, so...
28. We are in there as well, then.
Yeah, but you don't know. So that's always a difficulty with privacy, how you deal with it, and how to find a good guidance in your own company and for your own problem at that moment. Because every event is different, every incident is different, every country is different. And even here in Europe, we don't have the same opinions. And now we have the new legislation popping up somewhere next year. And imagine then that when a privacy incident will occur in your organization, you can have a Belgian DPA as an administrative point of contact. You can give your complaints to him, and an English guy will be the administrative guy, and a Finnish guy will do the investigation and will closing the incident. That will be, I think, a very complex nightmare in privacy solving issues. So that's where we're heading a little bit within the European Union. And even Vivian Redding said last year that privacy and security cost the European Union for about 2 billion euro a year because we are not in line with legislation. So that are, I think, real numbers to take back in the mindset that, hey, we have to do it together.
Well, it's especially important for you then as well, if you do something similar, to understand this. Now, these people are real, and this picture shall just show you that we don't have just these privacy managers or these privacy champs out there. The two people you see to the left are the ones who take care of privacy within Office 365, and the two at the right have actually an interesting job. They're working on Xbox. And when we did Kinect, privacy was fairly much at the heart of the discussion how we run Kinect and how we deal with the data. Because if you've ever seen Kinect, if I'm standing in front of an Xbox and Kinect starts to recognize me, it tries to figure out who I am and immediately locks me on with my profile. So if my son stands in front of the box, it takes my son's profile, and if I'm there, it takes mine. So there are a lot of privacy implications with the data we actually collect. So that was their job. So last but not least, I'm briefly touching on Tom's role here, and then he can give you the reality out here in the sub. We have these people, the privacy managers, leads, champs, depending on the business group you're in, whether you're working on a product or on the services or in a subsidiary like Ton, we have these people on part-time privacy roles. And their goal is, as I said, to be a partner. I'm going to touch the privacy review process, but it's Ton's job to be a partner to the marketing organization out here. And that's sometimes a tough job. It's not everything perfect within Microsoft. Marketing would like to do much, much more with the data they collect than they should. And that's kind of the discussion you have to have. It shouldn't be a tax. It shouldn't be a cop role, a policing role. It should really be a partner.
Yeah, guidance.
And governance.
You have guidance. That's what I do.
The guidance. They have to know the standards, obviously. Not only the privacy standards, but the security policies within Microsoft as well. How do we deal with data? How do we handle data? What's HBI, LBI, MBI, which is high business impact, low business impact, and the stuff in between is the medium business impact data. That's our data classification. And, you know, if standards don't meet the needs or we can't implement them, they are the ones going back to trustworthy computing and work with them to adapt them. And they need to be connected to their peers and to trustworthy computing and to the people they support. So, Ton, how's your life as a privacy champ out here in the Netherlands?
Very intriguing. Here in the Netherlands, we have about 1,000-plus employees running around in our subsidiary. So you can imagine that it's one of the biggest, I think, subsidiaries outside of the U.S., eh? We have here, right?
Well, no.
No?
You have UK, France, Germany.
Yeah, but are they also all 1,000 plus, I think?
Yeah.
But here in L, we said, you know what, we cannot do everything alone. You need to partner together with the business teams, with the business groups. So I have an expenditure about, say, less 15-20%, and sometimes you peak and sometimes you don't have something to do with privacy. So you leverage that out. And we said, you know what, we need to do also with champs. So every part within our subsidiary, the guys within marketing, privacy within marketing, privacy within online the online business, and then on the other hand, the privacy within public sector is totally something different. So it's difficult then to do everything good for all those segments within the subsidiary. So we said, you know what, every segment will have its own privacy champ. No, and in the Netherlands we have 12 of those guys, and their time consuming, it's about maximum of 5% of their daily duty on privacy. And that's good, because that's very efficient. And on one hand, and we can sort out all the issues. So if something happens within the marketing department, an incident occurs. So that's daily life sometimes. And then we manage those incidents. I will have a discussion together with the champ of them, or for instance, this case, the marketing guys. Then even when needed, with the marketing manager or with Coop to find out a way how we solve this. I think we have some other slides too with some...
No?
No. Okay. And the organization is very flat, but also open within the Netherlands. We say, you know what, we are not blocking the process of a new product line, but you need to do this together. So we give them advice, we're helping them out, and that's the way it works.
So for me, an interesting thing, sometimes when the big incidents happen, they bubble up to me. And we know, the thing I realized, the more active we have a privacy manager in place like Ton, the less incidents we have over time. It's fairly obvious.
Yep.
The last point with the people business is developing capability internally. Now, it's about training these privacy managers, and it's about making people aware, everybody at Microsoft, where the pitfalls are and the challenges are. Now, there are different ways we do that. Sometimes we do privacy days. Sometimes we just include it in normal ways we do training. At Microsoft, we have something we call Fast Start. That's typically when the new financial year starts. There's a whole list of trainings, mandatory online trainings I have to do. And one of them recently was privacy one-on-one, where I was just thought about the privacy laws, how we handle data, what's the life cycle of data, what I'm supposed to do and what I'm not supposed to do in my role at Microsoft. I'm not a developer. I'm sitting out there in the field.
Yep.
Additionally, we have a training called Code of Conduct or something like that. How do I have to behave as a Microsoft employee? And typically we take the incidents, the worst incidents we had over the course of the last year, and take them up again in a role play in a small movie to make people aware again of certain policies, what we are allowed to do or what we are not supposed to do. And sometimes these privacy themes show up there as well to make people aware of the challenges which we face as a company. So taking bad examples as well, without blaming Mr. X or Mrs. Y, taking bad examples and say, you know, last year somebody forwarded an Excel spreadsheet, and the Excel spreadsheet, the first tab was okay, but there was a second one which this person didn't realize, and there was PII, personal identifiable information in there, information which we should have protected, and that wasn't smart. Sometimes keeps people's mind around privacy as well, and we use these tools and vehicles to reach out to people. So if you want to do something similar in your company, you don't need a huge organization from our point of view.
You need it smart.
You need to do it smart, and you need to focus on different areas of expertise. For sure you need legal advice. I mean, it's about, on the one hand side, fulfilling the law. On the other hand side, again, it's about making sure that you meet your customers' perceptions as well. So you need legal advice. You have to understand your privacy policy if you have one. If you don't have one, it probably makes sense to write one. And you have to understand your business objectives. And then be a partner to the business to be successful. This is true for security, I'm deeply convinced, and this is true for privacy. If you're the Mr. No, sometimes you are the Mr. No. That's part of our job. But if you're only the naysayer, people won't ask you anymore. And that's extremely important if you do that. Now, you don't have to develop everything from scratch. There are a lot of resources out there. There's the IAPP, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, which gives you a lot of resources. There are other resources where you can use policies depending on which context you're working. So you don't need an organization of the size of Microsoft if you don't are a company at the complexity and the size of Microsoft. But you can actually do something similar on a much smaller scale in your organization if you want. Anything to add on your side, on the people side?
Yeah, maybe a small thing is try to understand that privacy is not a free thing anymore. If, for instance, if you use data for a certain event as a company, in the Netherlands it's not allowed to use that data for another event which will happen next week or next month. So you need to take care in account that if you do that, they are facing some serious risks, because in the Netherlands you need to opt in for your registration details and your name and all your stuff you want to do for this particular event. If you use it for another one, you can be having a fine. So that's not only in the Netherlands, but also some other European countries. So it's not a freebie thing anymore. It's serious.
And sometimes, which works sometimes, I used it once or twice in Europe, depending on the law, the country manager is personally liable for violations of privacy.
Yeah.
Personally, it's not the company, it's him or her. And that's sometimes a fairly good argument if somebody doesn't want to move. You go and say, by the way, it's you. It's not Microsoft, it's you.
Yeah, and it starts with 6 digits, huh? Sometimes.
Yeah. But that's the last step I'm typically taking. Before that, we try to do the motivation piece. When it comes to processes and policy, let me briefly touch on that. We have certain standards internally for sales and marketing, online advertising, developers, cloud services, and so on. Two are kind of important in the last few, probably months to years. The location-based services is an interesting one, especially if you look not only at the phone, but But in the future of slates and everything moving around, where you want to have all those location-based services, how do we deal with this information? And the last one is a good one, or an important one as well, is the collection of information from children.
Heavily regulated.
Heavily regulated. And especially if you go into Xbox or the phone even, that's an important part. Now, the privacy for developers part, there was an animation in there recently. The privacy for developers part is a standard which we made publicly available. So if you want to have that, it's on our website, and you can reuse it if you want. For us, it's kind of two sides to the coin again. We introduce privacy into the development lifecycle of a service, of a feature, of a product, or of a marketing campaign. So let me repeat that. It's the product, the features. So we don't take just Windows. We take similar step-by-step features in the product. The services, which is the cloud services we have, and all the marketing campaigns we do. So we kind of, if we develop them, if we have the concepts, I'm going to show you the review process in a second. That's one side. The other one is we take the same kind of data, but we take a different approach. It's then not the project we do. It's actually the data we have. So the whole information life cycle, which we try to make people understand as well internally what it means if you handle sensitive data. And it starts with small things. We have a fairly much a self-servicing environment at Microsoft IT. If I need a SharePoint site, I'm going to go to a website and say, I need a SharePoint site, and I want to call it Boo, and I have a second administrator, and then I'm guided through setting up a SharePoint site, and about 10 minutes later, I have my SharePoint site. Now, down that process, there is a form which they ask me, are you planning to handle personal identifiable information on the SharePoint site? If I click yes, first of all, it's classified as high business impact information. Second of all, I have to fulfill certain obligations because I deal with this data on the SharePoint side. If I say no, the next question is it Microsoft confidential, yes or no? And then just small things happened, like the SharePoint site on the top has a logo which said, by the way, this website is HBI, MBI, LBI. Those are small things which make people aware, using the process, make people aware that these things exist. The delete box over there, if you look at the data, will most probably get more and more attention when countries start to decide that we have the right to be forgotten. So I can call Microsoft, Google, Facebook will be an interesting one, LinkedIn, and say, I want to disappear from your network, delete everything which links to me. Go. So those will be new challenges which we might face, or sometimes they are even in country law already.
It's already here in the Netherlands.
Yeah. So the privacy review process is here to support features, products, services, marketing campaigns to implement the privacy standards. Now, you see these six arrows here. Those are basically three different phases. So the first phase are the first two arrows here, where we go out and collect information about the marketing campaign, about the feature. What are you planning to do? Who is responsible? What kind of data are you collecting? And so on and so forth. The second, the middle part, is the phase where we put the right people into a room, and that's absolutely essential. If you do these review meetings, make sure that you have the right people in the room who can take decisions. It's nothing worse than going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until you decide about the mitigation of a risk, being in privacy or security. So the first two boxes are actually here to figure out whom we need in the review process. Then we put the people into a room and look at risks and how we handle the data, talk about remediation, how do we deal with those risks, and then go back to the review meeting. So this part is kind of going in circles during the development of a marketing campaign, of a feature, of a service, up until the point where everybody is happy, and then we close out. Now, we all know, I'm working long enough in the business, we all know that we will reach a point where marketing says, and now I'm going to launch this campaign, and privacy says, no, you don't. Or where Windows 8 says, and we're going to ship Windows 8 because of business reasons, And privacy says, no, you don't, because you have an unacceptable risk in there. And there's an escalation process in there, which then goes up where people higher up in the ranks than Ton and me have to decide whether we as Microsoft can accept that risk or not. That there are risks in there which are not acceptable for us because they are not acceptable for you. And there are others where we say, okay, we might have to deal with that for business reasons. So there's an escalation process in there. And then we complete the documentation. We make sure that we understand all the documentation at the end. So if something bad happens, we actually understand where the problem started and how we are going to fix it. You wanted to say something?
No, it's okay.
Okay. So, as I said, the review, these privacy reviews, the middle two boxes, they are actually really important for the whole process for us. It's essential that we have the right people in there, from legal, from a privacy standards perspective, as well as the ones from the products and services, where we can decide about mitigations and how to go on. On the other hand, the product team has to understand what they have to provide and give this review team to be successful. And, you know, it's often kind of a consulting exercise, and that's the way it should be. We want to help the product teams to be successful within our privacy standards. So that's kind of the overview from a process perspective. I don't think that you need a huge process. If you look back to the people, if you have a few champs who understand the standards, if you have a few champs who understand the legal environment, depending on the size of your company, you can have a fairly pragmatic and slim process to move forward. You don't need the tools as well as we have them, and I'm going to show you one just in a second. You can actually have it fairly slim, but again, you need to have legal advice. The review process, you need to understand the legal boundaries you have, because they're obviously not acceptable to break them if they're black and white. If they're not black and white, you need legal advice on the risks you're going to take, and then you have to debate whether you want to take mitigations or not. And then make sure that your products obviously match your policies and standards, and again, the expectation of the users. They should be somewhere aligned. Leverage what's out there already on the internet. Last but not least, no, not last one, is tools.
Shall I do this one?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Suppose we have a marketing event running around, and we want to do something for the upcoming few months for a marketing event. We thought within Microsoft, you know what, we need to have a thorough process to cover all the risks involved with privacy in this case. Former slide, you had some rows said websites. Websites in the Netherlands need to comply to legislation, so they need to be checked. So somewhere in the process, somebody must check, do we have all those from government-issued communication links in our website? If you don't do that, you as a company are liable, because at that moment you have an incident. So what we do is we fill in the form. Most of the times I'm doing this. Then I will ask and I will fill in all those questions, and if everything is okay, it will be sent to my higher authority within Microsoft, in this case the privacy manager in Dublin, and he will review and tick off my boxes. So we have also four eyes principle about, do we follow the process correctly from a European and Dutch legislative point of view with respect to privacy. It's maybe a stupid long process, but you need to do it, because otherwise you are liable if you have those faults in your website. And if things are not okay, then we have something to manage. And those red cross things needs to be managed. And that's the feedback we have. And we only go ahead with an approval with the marketing guys. And I know they are stressing on time. We need to have this yesterday and all this stuff. Okay, I don't care. We need to sort this out.
May I briefly go back to the tool, please?
Yep.
Because what they did, Trustworthy Computing, let me go back to the beginning of the tool, is they aligned the policy approval manager with the process.
Yep.
I showed you initially. So I know that you can't read that one, but if you see the slides, you're going to see them. Basically, the first page is collecting information about what you want to do. I want to do a marketing campaign. I'm going to collect this kind of information. Yep. These people are involved, yada, 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 yada. So that's the first box of your process. And then you're going to answer a few questions. How is this information used? It's a new website. It's a marketing campaign. It's a new product I'm going to do. It's a new online service, which I just do internally. So basically, if I'm not completely mistaken from a figure perspective, but about 70% of the projects which start here and here actually stop at that point.
Yep.
Because we figure out there's no privacy review needed. And if they continue here, the goal of the first two slides, the first two screens, is actually to figure out whom do we need to do the privacy review. Who are the specialists we need to involve to have the right people in the team when we do the privacy review? So the questions you see from here and then the dashboard at the end, they are tailored to the beginning of the project. So if it's a marketing campaign, the dashboard, the questions, the mitigations will be different than if you do an online service for a cloud, a public cloud for children, something like that. And then, once you go through this process, that's a dashboard, as Ton just said, which we are going to manage.
Yep.
And this is not, to be clear, this is not the shipping product, what you see here. If we ship a product, we probably have a little bit less of these red X's, actually none of them anymore. When we go live.
And everyone is different. I've seen no PAM report with the same outcome.
And that's really important. Tailor what you need to do, because you don't want to bore your product teams. So that's the statistics of the first 12 months. This tool went live in July. July is obvious for us because that's the start of the financial year. July 2010. And within the first year, we had about 2,100 privacy reviews. And those are really just the reviews which went over the first hurdle. The rest stuck at the point where you collected the first piece of information about the campaigns.
Yep.
So it's actually fairly an intensive thing. I'm personally thinking that there should be more. Because if you look at the subsidiaries out there doing marketing campaigns on their own, there should be much more in here. So when the Netherlands runs a marketing campaign on their own, which is not driven by Redmond, it's basically something which should go through the privacy tool, to the privacy review, to make sure that either they don't need a privacy review or they need one.
Yeah, I agree.
And then things go wrong sometimes. So we have a privacy escalation process, which is fairly closely aligned from a thinking perspective, from a process perspective for us with the security escalation and the security response. I think the important thing here is everybody can raise obviously an incident. I mean, I can go to my privacy manager and say something went wrong and he has to take care of it. He will file it with Redmond. We are going to handle this process centrally mainly. And they will look into the incident, they will try to contain it, they will handle press, if something has to go to press, if we have to handle the press. But the important thing with all these incident response processes to me is, if you do something like that, don't stop at the moment where the problem is solved. That's a typical thing I see with a lot of customers. We do incident response, being it at security or privacy, and the moment the problem is solved, we stop. We take it one step further. I want to understand where the problem actually originated. Why did it happen? Can we change our privacy process?
Could we prevent it?
Could
we prevent it?
Can we prevent it?
Yeah.
Do we have to change something in our standards, in our checklists, to make sure that something like that doesn't happen anymore? Do we need to change the training, and so on? So try to close the loop with your privacy processes, with your review processes at the end of the day, to make sure that you learn from what went wrong. Doesn't really mean that you can avoid all the problems, but you might be able to reduce some of them. And, yeah? So the question was, when Sony had their incident, whether we reviewed our processes and make sure that we are compliant as well. I mean, we try to understand if a security incident happens like Sony or any other, take anyone, we try to understand whether it could happen to us as well, and it typically can. It's always a question of the level of sophistication you need to get in and how we can avoid these kind of incidents. Sure we do. And, you know, a few years back, a lot of years back, I was working at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and that was the time when the whole Enron case came up. And I knew that we had partners running around saying, "Pooh, it happened to the others. It could have happened to us as well." I think similar things happen here as well when incidents happen in the industry. Isn't it? Sometimes, I mean, there is a big case with Yahoo in Belgium currently, which determines which law enforcement authority is actually responsible for a case which happened, whether it's the one where the victim sits or the one where the data is or the one where you offer the services. I mean, typically you follow such cases being in privacy or security related and try to learn from them. And sometimes you're glad that it hits the others rather than yourself. So obviously we do, and I hope you do as well. You learn from things we do. And that's the reason why we want to talk about those things, learn from what we learned in the past. The same is true with the security development lifecycle. Take that and learn from what we learned the hard way in the past. Don't go through our...
Simple thefts are privacy incident. If your laptop is stolen or your phone, your mobile phone, contains data, contains customer data, personal data, sensitive data, photos of kids sometimes, your own kids, and that's handled as a privacy incident.
So before we go to the case study, do you have questions to the process, to the way we deal with privacy from what you heard so far? Is there anything open you want to address? I know it's late, but... So let me repeat the question first, please. The question is, we talked about different rules in different countries. Do we take the most strict rule, or do we do it country by country? Now you wanted to answer that. That's actually good.
Yeah.
Let me learn.
It's depending on country level, because what's allowed here that's not allowed in France or in Germany, or vice versa. So that's why you need to have a good understanding of what is allowed in your country on privacy legislation. The DPA here in the Netherlands is not very active on giving guidance to small and medium enterprises. I know the DPA in the UK does, and some countries around us too. So that can change, I think, for the upcoming few years a little bit. But it's handled case by case and country by country.
Now, this is true for all the marketing campaigns we do. For customer data we deal with, if you register for Tech at Europe, whatever. Where the challenge actually starts is if you do a cloud service, which you want to operate on a global scale. And there we try to follow the most strict rule if we don't kind of get hit by other requirements. As I said, you know, the one law enforcement says you need to keep your logs for 6 months, and the privacy or the data protection commissioner tells you you're not allowed to keep them for more than three. And so you have two countries with two different regulations, and they don't match each other. And this is where actually this pink box comes into play, the legal and corporate affairs. And where we don't have these teams, people like Ton and me, where we try to reach out to bodies like the EU and say, you know, actually, I don't care which rule is the one you want us to follow, but give us one where we can go down the road. You know, I don't care whether we have to keep them 3 months or 6 months or whatever, but give me a rule where I don't violate the law.
Because
Well, yeah, sometimes these things get more complicated because there is an open case and we have to keep the data. But that's then slightly a different thing again. But, you know, I don't want to get into the debate between privacy and law enforcement because personally I have my view, but that's a Swiss biased view, and I'm happy to be involved in this kind of discussion as a private person in Switzerland. But at the end of the day, those are the debates which we need to have publicly. And it's a debate I typically call for publicly as well. What do we want as a society between privacy and law enforcement? And incidents change this view. Look at 9/11. 9/11 dramatically changed the way people in the U.S. looked at the split between law enforcement and privacy. At least the government was immediately willing to give up privacy for the sake of law enforcement and fight for terrorism, against terrorism. So that's a debate which has to take place in any given country. The problem here is this debate ends up at a different point depending on in which country you are, which makes life, again, complex for people who operate globally. But I think I'm not seeing anybody, international body, who takes that up successfully within a given timely framework. Council of Europe does some work, the UN does some work, the EU does some work, and sometimes they even talk to each other. But it's kind of a slow-moving process.
Yeah, and the European legislation versus Dutch legislation, which will come out, has also always already, they did a match.
You are part of Europe, aren't you?
Yeah, but we know we are Dutch, are part of Europe, but we have some distinct features in our privacy and security legislation here in the Netherlands.
Is there any other question which we briefly might answer on this process tool thingy?
Okay.
Okay, go ahead with the case study.
For the case study, I took our Office 365 environment. Office 365, who doesn't know what Office 365 is? Luckily, okay. It's our online environment for our whole Office suite, including Outlook, and you have some certain contractual arrangements you can do within Office 365. And for this case, I took the P1, that's small and medium enterprises, where you have your whole Office suite in the cloud, Outlook, your email in the cloud, and you have also SharePoint and some other goodies. And Link, of course, our communication feature. My opinion is, and that's not only my opinion, but also that from Microsoft, is we said, you know what, we have to deal with privacy and security within the Office 365 environment. So the basic statement is your privacy matters. And why? Because you are owning your own data. If you go back to this slide, and the right big one, that's the management screen of your Office 365 environment. We can't do that. It's your thing. So it is within your secured environment. We want to be transparent in this case. So we said, you know what? We need to do something about giving and expressing and giving more information about what we do. What legislation, where it's located. We say, we respect your privacy of your data because we know you need to know where it exactly is. Where is my data? And Microsoft said, we have a European cloud, your data, Office 365 in Europe will be in Amsterdam or in Dublin, period. Then for transparency, we say, you know where your data resides, who can access it, and what we do with it. So that's all within the contractual arrangements. That's all within the arrangements we make with the customers, with you. So make this transparent. And if you raise the transparency in this case, you will have less discussions. Keep it open. And also, we have said, okay, to be transparent, to have a very good, robust environment, we agreed to the standards, international standards, the ISO standards, the EASA thing, and all verified on a regular basis by third parties. We even do pen testing on our environments and certain within certain time frames to continuously check, do we have the latest state-of-the-art technology with the latest state-of-the-art security, with the latest state-of-the-art privacy features and enhancements in our environment. And we have a zero tolerance within security. We say, whatever happens, we want to excel in cutting-edge security practices. So we say, data will be secured with a high standard, with the highest encryption standards. The access to the data will be also at the location we just decided on before you enter the contract, and also all the security metrics behind it, how to deal with it on network level, on server level, on data level, all the other stuff. So we do that fully to the max. And I think if you have this this type of story with emphasis on privacy, you all, yeah, I think it's okay. Actually, I do it by myself. I said to my kids and to my wife, I want to know what's happening over there. So I have also an own account on Office 365 for the privacy and the security part.
Office 365 actually was an interesting beast for me. When we launched the public service here, the public cloud, I mean, the public cloud is something which everybody had to learn as we go, somehow. We were operating in this space of the public data somewhere. And there was a close collaboration between the privacy team in this review process, the Yep. people in the field, being people like Ton and me, and the Office 365 team. And there were a few interesting outcomes. One was the trust center, which we have today, where you see, if you're a customer, you can log in, you see the audit reports, you see the policies, you see the data flows and all that kind of stuff. And the other, and then we came back to the Office 365 team and said, well, out of Europe, if you want to operate in Europe, we need to be able to sign the EU model clauses, which cover a lot of privacy as well. Otherwise, we are not able to sell. Now, from a risk management perspective, an interesting thing happened. We started to sell, even though we didn't sign the EU model clause at that point, because a lot of small and medium customers started to jump onto Office 365 for a security and operational perspective, taking the risk, being fine with it. And when we went down the road through these different processes and cycles, we started to jointly learn how we have to design a privacy policy and a privacy operations environment for Office 365.
Yep.
And the other thing which we need to learn, and our customers needed to learn, was that if we look at compliance, there are different layers. Our data center, they are ISO 20001 compliant since I don't know when. They did their SOC 70 report since I don't know when. But then we had another layer on top, which is the application. And they need to be certified as well. They had to follow these standards as well. So that's kind of the process we went through up to the point where we are today with Office 365. It was this iteration I showed you in the middle, which we had to go through together with the team, heavily influenced with the field team, who got all this customer feedback to make Office 365, to bring Office 365 to the point where we are today. And then Azure came into place. And Azure was, from a policy perspective, slightly behind Office 365. And Azure learned a hell lot from the processes we went through in Office 365. And all of a sudden, Azure had a trust center, and Azure gets transparent. And you saw, you might remember all these different wheels of our privacy program. Azure got transparency on how we do security and how we keep the data private and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the process we are trying to embrace at Microsoft, to learn from what we see in the field and what we did with other products into new products. That's kind of the thing you need to close. Now, one thing I wanted to mention on where the data is, because that's a discussion I have so often when it comes to the public cloud, to Office 365. We actually say, if you're a customer in Europe, we will keep your data within Europe most of the time. Yeah, that's the reaction I always get. Mm-hmm. The most of the time thing, yeah? So what happens if we lose the data center in Amsterdam? For any reason. Let's say they're flooded, gone, lost.
They're not going to happen. It's only 65% of this country is below sea level.
So won't that's, happen.
And even, I think, even Schiphol is in the below sea level.
So let's say we lose a data center in Europe. So there's one left. So what we are going to do in such case is we want to provide you with a hot standby again. So we are reaching out to you and ask for permission to move your data outside the Europe. If we would keep the agreement strict, we wouldn't be able to do that. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, but it needs to be said that we consult you up front of what we are
yes.
doing. But it needs to be very clear. We are not saying, okay, we allocated your data to the US or to the South Pole, whatever. But
the ice bears.
Yeah.
But just, I mean, those things are part of these privacy processes we go through. And Office 365 was an interesting exercise for us in this case. Please. So the question is, if he signs a contract in the Netherlands and the data is moved to another country, which law now governs his data? Do you know the answer? I don't.
I can a small shot on this one. Is that you're being consulted up front about which country you want to go and which options you have, we have. And you decide at that moment, because I can imagine for defense type of construction companies, it's not smart to relocate your data outside of your current data center and your agreements based on regulations like export compliance. So you don't want to do that.
That was the PR answer now, because you didn't answer the question.
That's different.
No.
If first ask you, you need to make your own risk assessment.
But the question is actually an interesting one. If you really need an answer to that one, give me your business card and I'm coming back to you.
Yeah.
I'm not a lawyer, so that's typically the point where I refrain from giving you a clear answer or yes or no.
Yeah, and I... Sorry?
Yeah, but the Swift case to me, they're Belgium. The Belgian company has to give data to the U.S. even though the Belgian law prohibits it. I mean, we have the same cases with the airlines since 9/11, because the airlines have to give my personal data to the U.S. before we actually leave the country, violating the privacy laws in certain cases. These cases exist, but I'm not sure whether they really cover the same thing as that's law enforcement terrorism thingy, and you talk about the incident. So if you want to have an answer, I can try to figure out if you give me your business card.
Yeah.
So let me try to close here a little bit. You, in my opinion, you have to focus on what you want to do, what you want to achieve, make the tools easy, make... In our case, when we come back to the initial portal we showed you, or the initial this PAM, the privacy, what's the A manager, assessment manager, something like that, integrate it into one environment, obviously. But you know, the trust center can be an interesting one for you to look at, how you can, in our view, and how we did it, give some transparency to our customers. The link is here. You have them on the slides. But don't try to boil the ocean if you do privacy. I think it's not that complex. It's a lot of common sense for us European. You need lawyers to be involved. That's that's the bad news.
It costs money.
Lawyers in the room. But you need to be governed by lawyers somewhere. But you can keep it fairly small and simple and straightforward if you have the right policies in place.
Keep it lean and mean.
Keep it lean and mean.
So those are the resources. You know that slide, I guess. I guess there's an evaluation slide. So submit the evaluations. But let me close now, please. What we try to do is give you an overview of how we handle privacy, give you some ideas how you could do it. It's a constant learning process for us as well. You saw that the tool, the PAM, this Privacy Assessment Manager, is 2 years old. Typically, it changes over time. It improves. We learn how the processes work or doesn't. And then new technology comes, like the cloud. We have to learn again. It's a constant evolution. But I think it's important that people like us in the field, people like the Trustworthy Computing team in Redmond who do the policies and the standards, and our lawyers are in a constant exchange. What's important for me out here? What do I need from a resourcing perspective to live in a subsidiary? What do I need from a global perspective, in my case, to handle questions like you just raised them? How can we deal with those issues in a partnership? Because if Trustworthy Computing, if legal would step up, especially in our class, in our environment, and would say, that's the way you do it, they will fail. Because we are so far away, they probably won't even notice that we don't follow the policies until it goes wrong. So this partnership is extremely important. Try to, if you want to do a privacy program, try to drive this partnership with your customers, and your customers are internally at the end of the day.
And use public information too. The EIPP site has good guidance models on it. The European Union has good guidance models on it. Go visit Article 29 Working Group, because that will hit us for the upcoming 2 or 3 years.
So the last point, just to give you a final remark before you submit the evaluations. About a year ago, we decided we have about 30 security people across the globe doing security work with governments and private sector customers. And we actually decided to train them on security. So we offered them the opportunity to use IAPP, this International Association of Privacy Professionals, and do the CIPP, the Certified Information Privacy Professional, as a certification. And the reason why I wanted to do that is because I'm deeply convinced that the security people have to understand the privacy world much, much better, and the privacy people have to understand the security world much, much better. So we have to build these bridges to be successful, and that's the reason why we did it from a security angle, and that's the reason why...
I want to add one thing on that one, is okay. That we have an US module in IAPP, and we have a European EU module. So... If you're EU-based or EU-operated, look into the EU part and the IT thing.
So that's the reason why two security guys are actually standing here talking about the privacy program.
One of the most boring moment of the day.
So the two guys who were in this room before us, the presenters said that they're going to go for a beer. I really liked them about 1.5 hours ago. So I hope it's time for you as well now. Enjoy the beer, enjoy the evening. And then enjoy the rest of Tech Ready. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.